If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, and welcome to episode 231 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
I want to start today with a social media comment from a friend that's been rattling around in my head. He was reflecting on the only two times he remembers colleagues openly weeping at work. The two dates he gave, September 11th, 2001, the day of the terrorist attacks on Washington and New York, and more recently, January 6, 2021, the insurrection at the Capitol. What struck them wasn't just the events themselves, but the feeling that even years after January 6th, the country still feels unsettled, brittle, exhausting to think about, and constantly on edge. Around the same time, I saw a post from one of my favorite writers, Derek Thompson, and that landed very differently. Thompson argued that while it may have been a bad year for American politics and 2026 was only a mediocre one for the economy, it was actually an exceptional year for the country, citing sharp declines in violent crime, overdoses and suicide, major medical breakthroughs, record wages, and real progress on issues that affect everyday life. What interests me isn't whether Thompson is right or wrong on the facts. Rather, it's how hard it is for many people to even hear that kind of information, because we just don't live with social media anymore. We live inside what we might better call algorithmic media, where the rules that decide what we see reward outrage, fear, and conflict, and where bad news reliably crowds out quieter forms of progress. Rick, how does living inside algorithmic media, a term I'll admit I stole from New York Times columnist Ezra Klein, shape the way we see reality, and what does that do to our moral judgment, our sense of hope, and our responsibility to each other?
We're living in a time of kind of negative propaganda, where it's not propaganda really for a political end dictated by a state, but it is propaganda nevertheless, in which we're fed a certain kind of slant or certain kind of perception on events. And you're right, it tends to reward fear and outrage more than anything else. And what happens in that kind of situation is we trust people less, we become more polarized, and we become less able to really evaluate in kind of an honest and reliable way what is going on in the world. And this makes us less, I would say, less informed and less practically able to influence our political environment in a healthy way.
I mentioned a minute ago that this is a term I heard Ezra Klein use about how social media really isn't social media anymore. I mean, it used to be when Facebook spun up and its other competitors, it was a place where you'd say, oh, look at the stuff my kids are doing at school. I'm really proud of my daughter for her tennis ribbon she won this summer at camp. Or, you know, my grandmother's struggling a little bit, we could use some help, or, you know, these things that were like super personal and also like in some ways like not attention grabbing, right? I mean, nobody outside of your immediate family cares that your daughter got a tennis medal. And I think these platforms quickly learned that to keep people on these places like Facebook and Instagram and other places, that you really need content that's stickier. And that's why the algorithm is so terribly important with what you see. I mean, I remember there was a product that caught my eye that I clicked on a couple of weeks ago, and I was like just slightly curious in a particular product. And I'm like, okay, well, that's all I need to know about this. But for like the next 4 days, all I saw were this and other products that were like, this person's going to be buying this, and we need to get in front of him in any way we possibly can so he'll spend his money with us. And like, we see that when it comes to commerce, we see that when it comes to TV shows that we may watch, and it just so much skews what we think everybody's thinking about, because we have this custom feed that's like delivering content to us all the time. And it is, and I think we sort of sometimes forget that it's sort of remarkable that there are, I mean, countless, you know, hundreds of millions of people who use these social media platforms, and like no two feeds are the same, right? It's all like hyper personalized due to what your interests are, due to where you live, and also to some extent who your friends are. I think you certainly must agree, and if not, we can discuss this, but that the way those feeds are constructed is such a large part of what we see, and probably we don't think enough about them, and mostly because we don't know how they work.
And it's not just social media. It's also the news services. So, and you, you know, working in digital media, you're well aware of how that works. When you click on certain kinds of news stories, those feeds are going to come up more on all these different platforms. And then you can also subscribe, whether it's in newspapers or journals, you can subscribe to different newsletters that will feed you certain kinds of content. And then that becomes overwhelmingly the kind of news that you're exposed to. So it's not just social media. It's really all forms of media then. And I find that I really miss the old days of having a physical paper, because I would come across stories, and just browsing through the paper, I would come across stories that
the algorithm would never think you care about.
Right. And the interesting thing is, I didn't even think I cared about it until I came across it, and then I'd read a couple lines and realize that this is something I didn't know anything about. I really wasn't aware of the existence of, it might be a country or a company or like some social issue that's going on. And I felt like I was much more informed about my community and the world, say 20 years ago, when most of my media consumption was physical newspapers. And I would go through, in the course of a week, about four or five different newspaper sources. Now I'm pretty much getting feeds, and everything's on my phone that I'm reading. And I don't read as much of the news because I'm not coming across the really unusual things. And I'm finding that I'm getting the same stories over and over.
Yeah, and that part is certainly true. And I think we've sort of sacrificed a broad base of knowledge about a lot of things to a deep reservoir of knowledge about fewer things. And I don't think overall that's healthy or good.
Yeah. So, I think one of the things I like about the current feeds is there are certain issues that I've been researching that I've really been looking into for, especially issues, any kind of story and research going on about social connection. And I'm getting feeds about it, and I'm finding out what it is. And so I can go quite deep into that in ways that it would have been very difficult to do 20 years ago. I'm grateful for that as somebody who's doing research on that topic. But it's not making me a better citizen. That's the key thing. It's not making me broadly informed about all the things that are affecting my fellow citizens.
I promise to get back to important things about being better citizens in a second, but I'm just curious. How do you most often listen to music? Meaning the radio, through like, you know, a program like Spotify or one of its competitors, through, you know, media that you have, that or you just tell your device to play songs by Johnny Cash because that's who you want to hear. That how do you listen to music?
Yeah, a combination of those things. I would say Spotify, Pandora. I use both of those a little bit, and I'll listen to different mixes. Those are especially for certain times where I want background music or something. And otherwise, it's mainly YouTube where I'm going and I'm putting in a certain artist or a certain type of music, and I want to learn something about them or hear a specific song.
Because I think this is common for people my age, and I will kind of loop you into that as well, that so much of my exposure to music as a kid was almost exclusively through the radio. I mean, that's how I discovered new artists. I mean, there are still songs, and everybody can probably say this, at least maybe everybody who's like older than 25, who like, there's certain songs I can remember listening to driving around like in my high school or early college days that just sort of take me back to that particular moment. And that I just sort of, and there's an artist I'm a big fan of now. This is going to make me sound like kind of a dork, but there was I remember living in a small town in Iowa, hearing a song on the radio, and they did a back announce the song, and I'm like, I really liked it. So I actually called up the radio station, said, who was that? Who played that song? And they told me, and I went out and bought the album and have been a big fan of that artist ever since. But like, I think that a lot of people don't just stumble upon these things like that as much as they used to. They're doing more what you're doing today of, I want to hear, I'll pick on Johnny Cash again, Johnny Cash on YouTube. So I'll go and say Johnny Cash's greatest hits and you'll get 10 songs and maybe that scratches the itch you were looking for.
The problem is I'm not being exposed to nearly as much new music as I was, you know, say 10, 15 years ago. There was a program on public radio, I think it was out of Philadelphia or something, that was about an hour and a half long program. I can't remember the name of it, that played kind of new music coming out and then would have usually an interview with one of the bands. And I would listen to that every week because I learned about all kinds of new music and it was really fascinating. I don't do that anymore. Most of my friends are not listening to new music.
Mm-hmm.
And thing is, I find that most of the people my age, contemporaries, are listening to the music that they grew up with. And so they're listening to the same old things. And so it's, you get stuck into a certain category. And even the things that I get fed are like music that is like 40, 50 years old. And that's not necessarily what I want to listen to, but it's part of living in this algorithmic media that the algorithms have determined. Because I'm a certain age, this is the music I like, and it's really hard to get out of that.
And to kind of go back to the part where you talked a few minutes ago about being a better citizen, I think in my mind, one of the worst examples of being a good citizen, and I try my best to, this is like the one thing I will call people out on in social media, is people who probably may share a political viewpoint I do, and to make their point are sharing something that's just nonsense. And to me, I think that, I guess I find myself being more critical of people who may look at issues the way I do, but are sharing things that are just not true, versus people who look at things differently than me and sharing nonsense. Because to me, it's like, oh, all the people who don't agree with me, they don't understand, and they're sharing crazy stuff.
That's just their standard anyway, you're thinking.
Right? But like, which probably isn't a great way to look at it. But if there's somebody who I see sharing something that seems like fits into a narrative that they want to believe, but is just not true, that's what probably bothers me the most.
You have kind of a contrarian mindset, and that's typical. But I tend to do the same thing. I tend to be more critical of the people with whom I share a kind of broad worldview, and then less critical of the people that I generally disagree with, because I'm more interested in understanding them. Like, why are they saying what they're saying? And I'm going to look into that a little bit more. But the people that I kind of know where they're coming from and they're just saying something that strikes me as really stupid or wrongheaded or just basically wrong in the facts, I'm going to be much more critical of them.
Well, and as an example, I want to be really careful that this is not true. But a couple weeks ago when I was on vacation, I was trying not to pay as close of attention to the news as maybe I otherwise would. Somebody during that period said, oh, did you hear Donald Trump had a stroke? And again, that is, as of this taping, absolutely not true. But I'm like, no, I hadn't heard that. And I was, and my first thought was like, I know enough that if that happened, that would be like the biggest story that everybody would be talking about a lot. And I'm like, well, where? And so I kind of like, where did you see this? Where did you find this? And miraculously, actually, was able to find the source of this. And it was some physician who speculated that by watching the president on TV, thinks it may maybe be possible. Well, I mean, that's nonsense, because I would ask, my first question for this doctor would be, how many of your patients do you diagnose by watching them on TV? And the answer, right, of course, is none. Yeah. So it was whatever it was. But I mean, but that's an example of something that, like, did you hear the president had a stroke? Can be like, and that is a big deal. And it just seems like there's so much of these things that people share that can be put in the category of big if true. And oftentimes the part about if true is just not true.
I find that really common among the different sports programs that because reels have become so popular, these short segments, how do you get somebody's attention? You posit something really outrageous, then you watch it and you find out, yeah, there's no basis for it, but it's an outrageous claim to get people to click on it to begin with. And it's really too bad that we're in a situation now where you have most people saying that is where they get their news, and it's a completely unreliable form of news, because there's no editors, mm-hmm, on these, right? There's no checks.
It's a very flat structure.
Which allows a real diversity of views, but for a whole lot of junk. For me, I keep pushing myself to spend more time reading good sources, and reading sources where there are real fact checkers looking into stories. And I really appreciate more and more long form journalism.
But long form journalism will often, if it's done well, have a headline that makes you want to read it. I mean, it's not going to be like, you know, here's why you should care about Africa would be a bad headline. But it has to be like about something and make you want to dig into it. But those long form journalism pieces, which are terribly important, are also not like one big hot take. And they're much more nuanced than that. They talk to, if done well, lots of different sources. And it's just hard to capture those things in real bite-sized chunks. And so I think it's obviously great that you appreciate that.
But it is what Derek Thompson's doing. So you started out talking about Derek Thompson.
No, that's a good point.
And this is why he feels like people aren't receptive to hearing what he's got to say about how, like, the world actually had a very good year. The United States, at least, had a very good year last year in most respects. People aren't willing to hear it because they're not really paying attention to it.
Or they're not. And I guess that's sort of it. We'll pay attention when we think things are in crisis. And there are things that sometimes are in crisis. But why do you think, though, that people, like, I saw a chart the other day. I think it was data that's probably pretty close to complete for last year that showed fentanyl deaths dropped dramatically. We hope they drop more. But there's certainly, that was a topic that we talked a whole lot about over the past decade or so, and that for reasons that I can't quite articulate right now, but I'm sure there are people who could, that we've really made some progress there. And that's like something to celebrate. But it seems like instead of saying, hey, what can we learn from this? Why are these numbers moving in the right direction? Why was this thing that was once a crisis being now better managed? Instead, we just want to move on to the next crisis. And I just don't know why we're wired that way.
Yeah, we're wired to paying attention to what stands out, the new and the unusual. That's probably, you know, historically or evolutionarily valuable for us to do that. Like in environment, especially given an environment where a lot of things don't change, and then paying attention to the few things that do. But now we're living in a very different kind of environment where things are changing all the time, and so we're paying attention to the most extreme changes, and that's probably not good for us. I give a lot of public talks, and what I try to do now, instead of just making claims, I try to show graphic evidence for different claims and put it in historical perspective. So one of the reasons is so that I can, whenever there's any kind of claim being made, you can put it in some kind of context that people can actually see it. So they have no choice but believing it. So, for example, there was a claim that was really widely spread in 2021, you know, the year after COVID, that for the first time, our life expectancy is declining.
At least in the U.S.
In the U.S. It was in many countries around the world in 2021, life expectancy declined because of the effects of COVID. It bumped back up to normal and then started increasing again at 2022.
The pandemic may have a reason there.
But there were no headlines in 2022 that life expectancy was back on track to its increase. But you get a headline about the bad news, and there were a lot of headlines about the bad news. And so it's not just that people are paying attention to that one headline. They're paying attention to the fact that there's a whole bunch of bad things happening. And so then you can take that and you can show the evidence, and you can show that, well, for about 150 years in the United States, life expectancy has been increasing year after year after year. And so our life expectancy now is much greater than it was for our great-great-grandparents, right? And there was a little tiny dip in 2021, and then it started going up again. That tends to put that sort of thing in perspective. The problem is it's not a complete corrective, because it's only correcting that one headline. And what we're paying attention to is dozens of headlines about bad things happening. And so it doesn't correct the overall impression that, well, yeah, that might be the case, but still we're living in a time where there's all kinds of bad things happening.
And I think that's part of it. I also think, though, that, you know, we've even said this in the show, but I think it's like objectively true, is since the end of World War II in the world, we have lived through, well, I guess 90 years or 80 some years of like some of the most peaceful time this world has ever seen.
Yeah.
But you say things like that, and some people will say, well, you must not understand, Rick, what's happening in Ukraine right now. Or you must not understand these awful civil wars that are raging in parts of Africa right now. So, Rick, you just don't know what you're talking about. Or when you talked about this life expectancy issue, people would say, oh, but Rick, you don't understand that at least in the United States, we have a failed healthcare system that is just making those who are living in the margins of America can't afford the care they need. And it just sounds like at least to some people, when you share this good news, their instinctual reaction is to say, oh, you just don't understand. There's a lot more bad stuff out there that you just don't know about.
And I think that comes from an attitude that if you are sharing something that's good news, it must mean that you are discounting the bad things that are happening, that you don't really care about certain people or about the misfortunes of others. And I don't think that's the case. You can emphasize the good things that are happening while still acknowledging that, yeah, like for some people, their lives are getting worse, or some people are struggling in certain respects, or certain bad things are happening in the world. You can acknowledge both the good and the bad. I guess that's a difficult move for some, but it's what you need for an honest appreciation of the world that we're living in.
And I do think, even though I like calling social media algorithmic media, that I do think we all have more responsibility, maybe more responsibility than we should have, of making sure we are sharing, whether it's digitally or just in conversations with friends, like stuff that's true. And you mentioned earlier correctly that, you know, we have, you know, we don't have editors who are sitting there deciding which information to disseminate and not disseminate. It all sort of happens in this mercurial algorithm. And because of that, I think we all are in some ways fact checkers, that we, or at least we should be, and that we all should be more careful about the news we're sharing. And I guess I think that's easy to agree with. What I guess the question I have, though, is do we also have the responsibility to make sure that we're not always sharing the good, happy news and not always sharing the grim, depressing news, but that we're like kind of trying to strike some sort of healthy balance?
Yeah, balance in terms of proportionality, proportionality of like what is the genuine good things that are happening that we can acknowledge? What are the crisis or the things that we have to be concerned about and address? We have to do both, and I think that's become really difficult in a time where we individually determine the content of the news that we perceive. So like at one time, I mentioned, say, 20 years ago, when I would browse through newspapers, my impression of like the state of the world and the state of the nation and of the community came largely from what was given by the editors of these papers and a few other news sources that I would check in with. Now it's determined overwhelmingly by either the algorithms that feed me certain kinds of news stories, or if I'm more selective about my own pursuit of certain kinds of stories. But either way, I'm not sure I'm getting an accurate representation. If it's my own, like, what is the basis for me of knowing what stories to select and pay attention to so that I get an accurate picture of what's going on in the world? I can't stand up on a mountaintop and look around and see like what is down below me. We are immersed in this digital world right now, and trying to figure out what is going on, and it's overwhelmingly. There's too much information to try to even get something like an objective or neutral perspective on the condition of things.
I listened to a fun podcast the other day. Do you remember the product called TiVo, T-I-V-O?
No. It sounds vaguely familiar. Was it a television?
It was the first sort of customer, consumer ready DVR. This is before you would get a DVR through your satellite or cable provider. This was one you kind of could buy off the shelf. And it was the first time people had like hard drives in their living rooms, sitting underneath their TV, where they could record shows and you know, do all the stuff that we sort of take for granted now. And it was, and I, so I was listening to these people kind of, it was sort of like remember when this, like, it was a, you know, kind of a retrospective show about the importance of this product back when it came out in the late 90s. And what I found interesting was that it was maybe one of the very first products where if you watched, I think it was X-Files was popular back then, it would actually suggest other shows that it thinks you might like, which was like revolutionary for that time.
Right.
And I remember one of the people on this podcast talking about that. And two things struck me. One, she said that she started being more careful of what she would like. I think it was only what you recorded, maybe, or maybe it was what you watched, but she would be more careful about what she would watch or record, because she wanted to make sure like the TiVo was not like thinking she wanted to watch trashy TV, that it would somehow think that, you know, she has refined taste, that you know, I'm only going to recommend these really high quality shows because I see this as someone who really appreciates, you know, important programming. And I don't think, and that's something that seems like such a dated thing to think about right now, but that was what she really thought about. And she said, but also, and I actually had a TiVo, but I don't remember this, but it was also one of the first products where you, like, I don't know who like a celebrity example was, but like you have like a celebrity, whether it was in TV, music, movies of the day, who they would share their TiVo list with you. Like, here's what I know Bruce Springsteen probably isn't a good example, but I'll pick him. Here's what Bruce Springsteen watches on his TiVo. So you could like try to like decide, hey, I want to be more like Bruce. And it's just like funny how these were like things that were new to us back then, and how it's so different now. And I think what is, and I don't think TiVo was leaning into the all bad news and all these negative polarizing content is what gets eyeballs like our algorithmic media does today. But I'll try to do an awkward transition to ask about the dangers you think that having people being so fed these negative stories all the time, reinforcing all the things they believe to be true, that is not good for democracy, right?
No, it's not. One of the things we need for democracy is knowledge of one another. And then a real, fairly honest or reliable appreciation of the state of things, of the state of the nation. And I think it's really hard to get that right now. And because we are notoriously unreliable at evaluating evidence for ourselves, we're very biased creatures. And so we need need outside influences to correct our biases. What algorithmic media does is reinforce those biases, and so it makes us even less reliable as evaluators of the state of things.
And I would say all that's true, but isn't even what's worse than that is not when people like you and people like me are influenced by this, but also when people in power are either influenced by this or using these as tools to influence others. That just seems like the worst of all worlds.
Well, it's a cycle. The only reason that officials can do that is because we are so confirmed in our own biases that we will readily believe or disbelieve like certain kinds of predictable things. I guess I'm more interested in how we avoid it. And for me, one of the things is I still subscribe to one newspaper where I get the actual paper that I go through every day that exposes me to stories that I would not ordinarily select. And that's the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of...
And this is the paper version.
It's the paper version. So I can go through it, and I don't have time every day to go through the whole paper, but I can browse through different sections, and I look at the opinion pieces. I also listen to some radio programs, usually NPR, which gives me a very different slant on things than the Wall Street Journal. And then I'll listen to or read a few sources, and then I listen to a number of podcasts. But I vary it up quite a bit from one week to another so that I'm not reliably paying attention to the same sources.
What'll be fascinating, and I just read something about this today, I think, is that I don't know if you know who Johnny Ive is.
No.
He was sort of the Steve Jobs right-hand guy when working for Apple, and was credited with sort of the early designs of the iPhone and maybe the iPad too, and was very much a design first guy. And for reasons I don't quite remember and probably doesn't matter, he left Apple some time ago, and he is now working for OpenAI, which is, of course, the parent company of ChatGPT. And it was announced earlier this week that they hope by the end of this year, so sometime in the next 12 months, to debut this much talked about but little known piece of hardware that is going to be coming out that clearly interacts with this software, the ChatGPT software. Will it have a screen? Will it be something you talk to? Will it look like, in the form factor, be like a cell phone? I mean, none of these things anybody knows, and there have not been any leaks yet, and maybe there won't be until it's released. Who only knows? But it will be fascinating to see. I mean, we've all we've talked plenty on this show about cell phones and how they have changed our world and how it's changed how we interact with people and how we interact with ourselves. But they really haven't changed that much. I mean, like, the screens have gotten better and the batteries maybe have gotten better but I mean, they were like, the functionality hasn't changed much over 10 years, and it will be interesting to see what happens if this new device gets traction. I mean, there's a long list of technology hardware that is talked about in big and important ways and sort of flops. And this may well be one of those. But if this doesn't, if this is sort of like some new tool that allows us to communicate with others, to somehow organize our lives, to learn what's going on in our world, it'll be fascinating to see what comes down the pipe, because I think cell phones are kind of like a finished product. I don't think they're going to be very different now, and this may be what's coming next. And I don't know if it fits into any of this, but it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, and no, we haven't talked on this program about AI in depth for quite a while. We've mentioned it now and then, but we need to do it again in an upcoming show, because I think I saw a story about 60% of adult Americans now are using AI on a regular basis. Now, they're using very different kinds of programs for different functions. A lot of it is work-related, but it's become, in a very short period of time, and really over the past year, really widely adopted.
Yes.
And we haven't talked about that recently, and I think we need to do that. And I think when these new programs come out, it's going to be revolutionary for that reason.
Yeah, I was just traveling in Puerto Rico a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of the places I went, you know, had menus or signs that I wasn't able to read. My Spanish is not good, and I remember one time sitting in a restaurant and had the appetizer page open and said, you know, took a picture of it and gave it to Claude and said, which of these should I order? And it said, well, maybe this one or that one, and kind of described them. And I'm like, okay, that's what I'll get. And you know, I mean, obviously it's a terribly low stakes thing, right? I mean,
right,
it's not
right,
going
right.
to like, you know.
But it's possible.
It's possible.
That's the thing.
Yeah, it, yeah. And there's many more high stakes things that we're going to create for this other than getting a quesadilla.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, I hear you have one for me.
Scott, I just read a story recently that one of the fastest growing segments of the gig economy is training AI to do essential job tasks. So some tech companies that are in the process of developing and refining their AI programs are hiring people in different professions to help train their bots, their AI. And so I'm just curious, if you were offered, say, $250 an hour on your own time to help an AI company develop its decision support tools for its AI programs for journalists, would you be inclined to take that job, knowing that once it's completed, it's probably going to put journalists out of work?
So a couple of things. You know, there's many, I would say most, industries that are dipping their toes into AI, or sometimes dipping like their, I guess if you dip your toe, then you dip your entire body in, I don't know, but dipping more than their toe into AI. And it is sort of the, you know, long since been the buzzword around many businesses. Journalism is but one of them. There are certainly worries in a wide range of industries about what this means in the short, medium, and long term. And I'm by no means am going to be able to talk about things in industries with which I'm less familiar, although you hear things like maybe being a paralegal isn't like the best job path right now, because there's a lot of things that can be done by AI. I mean, it was funny. Just a few years ago, we told everybody to learn how to code, and that seems like less of a good idea than it used to be. So, you know, all this seems to be changing quickly. I would think I have some insight into how it affects the industry, journalism, and newspapers that I've spent my entire professional career at. And it's certainly not a secret that there are fewer journalists working in most communities across the nation than there were 25 years ago. And I think that there are a lot of things AI can do to make those people's jobs easier or make that work more streamlined. It kind of reminds me back in the day when many newspapers went from shooting film, you know, pictures with film, and then you take a picture, go back to the newsroom, take apart the camera, go into the darkroom, develop, and all that stuff. And I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there, but I don't know of many people who got into photography because they like spending an hour every night in the darkroom. That's not why most people get into this. And I think a lot of that can be said for journalism. There are some really good transcription programs. We use one of them in our company that really make it easy for you to have an interview with someone, and that does real-time transcription, so you don't have to go back and play back your tape and say, oh, what did Rick say 5 minutes in? So some of those things just make their job so much easier. And also, the other thing which I think is sort of unappreciated about AI in the industry in which I work is it can be a really good brainstorming tool. Like, you know, there's a new factory going to be opening in your city that's going to employ 5,000 people, and it's going to take these sort of resources. And you know, what are the 10 stories I could consider doing over the next 2 weeks that would help better explain this to readers? And, you know, I've done things like that, just hypothetical exercises with various LLMs. Usually they come up with good ideas. Sometimes they come up with like kind of crazy ideas, but you know what? They're just ideas. You know, you still have somebody out there who can say, hey, this is a story we want to chase down. And yeah, there may have been days where newsrooms were filled to the brim with editors and reporters where you could kind of gather everyone together and say, hey, here's the big news story of the day. How should we approach this? And when those numbers aren't quite as big as they used to be, having these sort of digital brainstorming sessions can be pretty useful. So I think in those sort of supporting roles in journalism, AI can be really useful and sort of let people and journalists focus on the reason why they got into journalism. What we are so far away and may never be able to do with AI is say, okay, we're having this big story and we need to talk to the mayor, and we need to talk to the city council president, and we need to talk to somebody who's, you know, using my analogy of a big factory opening up, you know, who the land where it's going, what, you know, the utility, you have all these people to talk to, but like you have to craft the questions and talk to these people. And then, you know, maybe you have an AI agent who can transcribe the interview back, but you still have to go through and say, you know, how are we going to weave these different things together and put it together? Yeah, maybe when you're done with your story, you may want to run it through and make sure all the grammar's right, make sure all the spelling's correct, make sure you may even want to say, you know, we brainstormed this idea. Here's my final product. Are there any angles I'm missing? And it may even say yes, or it may say no. But it really is still depending on journalists to go out and do the reporting in the community and build those relationships with the people, not only the people like mayor and other people in leadership, but also the community members who are equally as important. So to get around to your question, $250 an hour seems like a pretty good deal. I think it's probably dangerous to say from an ethics standpoint that if I don't take this job, someone else probably will. So it's not like, will this work get done, but who will do the work? Will it be me? Or if it's not me, it will be someone else. I would like to think that I have some you know, I might, if I determined I had the requisite skills for this and I had the experience to do this, I would certainly consider it. It certainly seems to be a pretty high paying opportunity, which isn't all bad. And I would also like to think that I would do this in a responsible way that would not say, we can just fire everybody and have computers do all the work. Because, I mean, you're not going to be able to, like, talk to people at this point in our AI
development. So if I would summarize this, I think you would say, I think you're saying it actually wouldn't put journalists out of work. It would help them do their job better. And perhaps this, you didn't say this, but you were kind of implying, it might even improve journalism by allowing for the coverage of more stories or more in-depth stories than are currently feasible right now.
I mean, ideally, yes. Just like, you know, when we went to digital photography from film photography, it allowed photographers to go out in the field and take more pictures and spend less time in the darkroom, and that was what matters. So I think it's similar to that. Obviously, I can't, in this role that you're in, this job that you're assigning me, I don't set budgets. I don't make decisions on who to hire and things like that, it doesn't sound like. So those are decisions that are going to be made independently from me. I think if I could, like, wave a wand and say we should double the headcount at every journalism shop in this country, I would think that would be a great thing. But I don't have that wand and nor the ability to do that. But I do think that empowering journalists at some of our largest papers and organizations and some of our smallest ones to use this responsibly and to use it in ways that can help them do their job better, I think not only is that like a great gig and getting paid $250 an hour, I think it can also further the pursuit of good local journalism.
This is a genuine question. I don't know if I were asked the same sort of thing. I'm not sure what I would do, but a lot of it would depend on, I think, what you are focused on is how likely is it really to put people out of work? How likely is it just to make some of our work more efficient and maybe improve the quality of it somewhat?
And I guess when I said, you know, that if I don't take this job, presumably someone else will. That is sort of an ethical trap, though, in a way, right? I mean, if somebody has, like, asked you to do something terrible, I'd be like, well, I guess I, you know, obviously for some sort of...
That is, like, goes to the heart of one of the issues between the two main competing ethical theories, utilitarianism and Kantianism.
Okay.
With utilitarianism, you just look at the consequences. And so you'd say, well, yeah, if I don't do it, somebody else will. And so the end result is the same. The negative effects on the journalists and so forth who might be counting on not having this to do their jobs. But then I lose the possible benefit of the $250 an hour. And so maybe I should do it. Kantianism says, like, more or less the golden rule, treat other people the way you would want to be treated. Don't do something that you think other people shouldn't do. And so if you think it's something that other people shouldn't do either, you shouldn't yourself. And so it's based more on evaluation of the kind of action it is, not what the consequences are. And that's where that difference comes in. I would say most of us, in practical terms, are utilitarians right now. We tend to evaluate first what are the possible consequences.
Would you put yourself in that bucket?
No. I'm much more leaning toward the Kantian side. I think we ought to look at the type of action that we're doing, and if it's something that we would be disappointed if other people did it, we should not do it ourselves.
I guess just to stay on that for just a second before we close. Like, tell me a job that you, not saying you don't have the skills to do, but that you think would, okay, here, you think that, I know you've talked about this show often about gambling is bad, right?
Yep.
So my guess is for $250 an hour, you would not work at a casino.
No.
And maybe this is not quite a great example because I'm not sure what even if you did choose to work at a casino, how you could dissuade people from gambling, because you probably wouldn't keep your job very long. But, like, there are circumstances I could think about where
I would say I wouldn't even I would not work in the sports industry right now.
The professional sports industry.
Yeah, because it's like all basketball, football, baseball, they're all being supported by like DraftKings and you know the
That's a better example.
Like, yeah, I would not participate in anything where the funding is primarily derived through gambling.
Okay, because, so that's a better example than my casino example. So then, staying on that though, if you were like, I'll pick on baseball because I know that better. But like, you would not think that, gosh, if I got a job in the commissioner's office where like some of these decisions are made, maybe I'm not going to entirely roll back every poor decision they've made around this, but I might make a difference on the edges. And if I don't do this job, they could get somebody in there that is like totally in bed with all these gambling folks, and they wouldn't even give this a second thought. So isn't there an argument to be made that somebody like you in a position might have some positive impact? So there would be a good reason for you to take that job, because it would possibly be an agent for change.
There's a slight case to be made. I think what is much more likely is that if I did take such a job, I would be fired in fairly short order, because I would be such a passionate objector to the way in which the sport is receiving most of its funding. I would have to say, yeah, I would have to do some job where I would have a clean conscience.
And have to otherwise get your resume ready, because you won't be there long.
That's right.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and also be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.